Hei hei, og velkommen til podcasten Goffeng på leting. På denne podden skal vi ha lange, rolige samtaler hvor vi leiter etter svar og forklaringer på hvorfor den tiden vi lever i såpass polarisert og kaotisk som den Podden produsert I samarbeid med Tenketanken Agenda, men det jeg som står ansvarlig for innholdet. Og det innholdet vil vi gjerne ha kommentarer på Facebook-siden, som også heter Goffeng på leting. Vi har også lyst til å være litt lyttertrevet. Så hvis dere har forslag eller ønsker om hvem vi skal snakke med og hvordan og hvorfor, så tar vi veldig gjerne imot det også. Så velkommen som sagt, og vi snakkes. Denne episoden trenger en liten intro. Jeg beklager det dårlige opptaksutstyret, men sånn måtte det bli. Grunnen at den samtalen vår med hovedpersonen den startet veldig, veldig brått, så vi fikk egentlig ikke introdusert den. Men det altså snakk om professor Niklas Christakis på Yale. Han Sterling Professor of Social and Natural Sciences der, hvor han jobber på The Human Nature Lab stort sett med sosiale nettverk. Hvis du følger den amerikanske kulturkrigen, så har du kanskje sett professor Christakis stående på The Campus Green på Yale, omringet av skrikende, illsinte studenter. Men jeg lovte ikke å snakke så mye med om det, så vi snakker bare om boka hans, som heter Blueprint, The Evolutionary Origins of a Good Society, som en strålende sak. Først pratet litt med Vegard Harsvik, som har skrevet en bok som heter Homo Solidaricus, han og en til, som vi også får høre navn på. De to bøkene overlapper litt, så det var artig å ha med Vegard på denne samtalen. Jeg sliter litt her med at jeg plutselig hadde tidsberensning, det jeg ikke vant til. Så det var et tema som jeg hadde egentlig lyst til å bruke mye tid på, som ble litt bunta sammen på slutten, og det vil dere antageligvis høre. Så vi hopper inn I samtalen akkurat I det jeg har gratulert forfatterne av Homo Solidaricus med å få pressa inn sitatet Romanes eunt domus, Romanes eunt domus. Det kommer fra en film som du helt sikkert har sett. Vegard var selvfølgelig mektig imponert over at jeg tok den referansen. Og hvis du også tar den referansen, så du absolutt da den typen person som jeg godt kunne tenke meg å ta en pils med den kveld. Så da kjører vi episode.
Felles, da snakker vi felles kulturell bakgrunn. Jeg pleier å sitere mye fra... I hvert fall jeg snakker politikk, siterer mye fra Yes Minister.
Ja.
Der alt. Der alt. Du trenger å vite om politikk og samfunn, det finnes I Yes Minister.
Jeg har jo da jobbet I tre departement, I politisk ledelse I tre departement. Jeg kan bare si at den var morsom når man så den sånn utenfra. Sett fra innsiden den jo fantastisk.
Ja, det skal jeg tro på. Ja, det noe gullkorn der, altså.
It's the will of the people. And I am their leader. Yeah. I must follow them.
Ikke sant. Det mye sånn. Jeg liker den der. Jeg brukte en del den siste Parkinsons law. Han snakker med en økonom inn på et kontor der. Han snakker om Parkinsons law of social work. Parkinsons law en reell sak, men det, jeg tror det ble laget om byråkrati eller administrasjon først. Han sier noe sånt som at administrative oppgaver vokser for å fylle opp antall administratorer du har ansatt. Det ikke omvendt. Det ikke sånn at du har oppgaven og så ansatt I det. Da snakker han om det som, for det en kommune, distrikt som har veldig få social workers. Og det var bra, for det også få social problems. Jeg tror vi lider litt av det der I en del diskusjoner akkurat nå. Parkinson's law. Ja, skal vi bare begynne? Jeg har satt på rekke allerede, jeg for så vidt, men...
Vi får starte.
Ja, vi får det. Hallo igjen. I dag har vi... Det ikke en dobbel episode. Det en og en halv episode, skal vi kalle det det. Først skal vi snakke med Vegard Harsvik om boka hans Homo Solidaricus, som han har skrevet sammen med.
Ingvar Skjerpe.
Ja. Og så om et kvart til 20 minutter så ringer vi opp Nicolas Christakis ved Yale, som har skrevet boka Blueprint. Så skal vi snakke med han også, for disse to bøkene litt... forbundet med hverandre.
Ja, de handler om de samme tingene og har vel omtrent som overgripende konklusjoner da, som jo et stort og positivt budskap. Det passer jo bra I disse juletider at vi sprer det glade budskap om at folk egentlig ganske alright. Folk ganske alright dyr, skrev Klassekampen når de omtalte boka. Vi var litt...
Folk og sauer.
Litt sint på selv for at det ikke var vi selv som kom på akkurat enda, om at folk all right til dyr. Men det litt, ja, litt essensen I Homo Soldaticus og den blueprint-boka hans, og egentlig veldig mye av det som har kommet av nyere forskning da, fra evolusjonsbiologer og psykologer og adferdsøkonomer og sånn, som ser på hvordan folk faktisk oppfører seg og hvordan ting henger sammen.
Vi nå, men nå vi egentlig hoppet vi litt for fort. Vi må vite hvem du først.
Jeg jobber I landsorganisasjonen I Norge. Jeg sosialdemokrat, vært politiker for Arbeiderpartiet en del steder, både storting og regjering, og nå jobber jeg med det som på fint heter samfunnskontakt og strategisk arbeid i LO. Og har skrevet noen bøker. Og den Homo Solidaricus den siste, og der har jeg trådt lengst inn I inkompetansens verden. Da.
Alt spennende.
Vi,
boka heter Homo Solidaricus som et svar nærmest på ja,
et oppgjør med myten om det egoistiske mennesket ja. Liksom,
Homo economicus
ja, ja under titelen det jo sånn at
forklar først hva det for noe Homo economicus I tilfelle noen der ute
Homo economicus det som I veldig mange år har vært standardmodellen for hvordan vi mennesker oppfører seg så en som finnes I de modellene man lærer på store deler av økonomistudiet, som står opp om morgenen og tenker hvordan skal jeg nytte maksimere dagen min I dag, og som opptatt av seg selv, hva man kan få ut, og der andre mennesker og omgivelser og natur eksternaliteter som man eventuelt kan ta hensyn til. Det jo en karikatur.
Mm. Det jo en veldig kald og hyperrasjonell
ikke sant, karikatur. Ikke sant. Mm. Og så, helt tilbake til Sarli Adam Smith, så har økonomifaget, som etter hvert grunnlaget for mye av hvordan vi bygger samfunnet vårt, har tatt utgangspunkt I at vel når alle opptrer på en sånn måte at det gavner en selv, så vil en slags usynlig hånd sørge for at det likevel blir til det beste for hele samfunnet. Og så har jo ja, så riktig gamle dager så mente jo folk at det var en Gud eller en religiøs orden på verden, altså at en Gud gir et embede, gir han også forstand. Gud har satt folk inn I de posisjoner og de roller de satt I, og det får de være fornøyd med. Når noen har mye makt, så det fordi at det bestemt ovenfra. Og så kom jo etter hvert darwinismen og evolusjonslæren, som der man etter hvert kan si erstattet mye av den her gudegitte synet på at forskjeller noe som kommer fra oven med at vel når det forskjeller I verden så det fordi den sterkeste overlever og når evolusjonen virker, så det jo sånn at det noen som overlever, og noen som får mye, og noen som får mindre, og det naturens orden. Så både Darwin og Spencer og andre har jo blitt brukt for å rettferdiggjøre kan si, en type samfunnsorden. Da. Så det at man har gått til biologien for å rettferdiggjøre sitt politiske syn, da, jo noe som har skjedd helt siden av slutten av forrige, eller århundre før der igjen da. Mm. Det første som slo oss da, når vi etter hvert begynte å dykke ned I denne materien, jo at alt dette og denne måten å betrakte biologi og menneskenaturen på, är ju utan spor av allt det de sista 10 åren har lärt oss då som jag sa av atfärdsbiologer och
som handlar om samarbete och fällskap.
Inte sant, inte sant. Så vi har då försökt att se på en slags populärvetenskaplig lekmans uppsummering av den kunskapen som vi har från de sista 50-60 åren om hvordan folk egentlig er, at det samarbeidende mennesket og det solidariske mennesket, som vi kaller det da, også står på skuldrene av en natur der du finner samarbeid i veldig mange former og på veldig mange områder. Det er jo Dag Hessen har jo skrevet en fantastisk bok som heter Vi, der han sier at det meste i naturen er vi, når man ser seg rundt, altså helt fra cellenivå, der cellene våre består av to separate enheter da, med forskjellige genetiske koder som oppfyller forskjellige roller i cellene våre. Da. Og derfra og opp, altså kroppene våre består jo av en del oss selv, men ikke minst store deler av andre organismer, bakterier og parasitter og andre som bor i oss og med oss og som vi har lært er med på å gjøre oss som organismer til det vi er. Da. Så alt er på en måte samarbeid. Da. Ja.
Så dere hevder og prøver å demonstrere og gjør det ganske rimelig bra, synes jeg, at Homo solidaricus, samarbeidsmenneske, vi er mer tunet gjennom evolusjonen til å samarbeide enn til å være disse kalde robotaktige maskinene som bare går etter egen
mening.
Sosialdemokrati er på en måte naturstillstand.
Ja, overraskende nok så er det konklusjonen da, at samarbeid og tillitsbaserte samfunn da, er gode samfunn å leve i for alle.
For øvrig som jeg sier der ute at Christakis kan ringe her når som helst. Vi vet ikke hvor lenge vi blir sittende her og prate om dette. Kanskje vi blir avlyst om å plukke det opp etterpå.
Han er en stor internasjonal stjerne, så jeg gleder meg til å høre han. Hvor var vi?
Vi var på at sosialdemokratiet var en naturtilstand.
Ja. Nei, vi er jo plastisk, det er jo en ting som både som han skriver om og som vi også har plukket opp i boka vår, da, at kultur former mennesker. Mm. Kultur former mennesker på lang sikt gjennom at de er med på å de spiller sammen med genene våre. Da. Men også hvordan du bygger et samfunn. Hvis du bygger et samfunn med utgangspunkt i at folk er til å stole på at vi er, som man kaller det, resiproke altruister, at vi er folk som i utgangspunktet behandler hverandre bra, så bygger man gode samfunn som er gode å leve av ut fra det. Men du kan jo også bygge samfunn på helt andre verdier. Vi skriver litt om et miljø på Handelshøyskolen i Bergen, som heter Choice Lab, med Alexander Kappelen som leder, som har gjort forskning over hele verden, der man har gjør disse forskjellige spillene, da, der folk kan velge hvordan de vil dele en pengesum, eller hvordan de oppfatter hva som er rettferdig og ikke rettferdig, og det viser at det er jo ganske store kulturelle forskjeller mellom for eksempel USA og Norge da, på hva man oppfatter er rettferdig og hva man er villig til å godta av forskjeller. Det er et interessant eksperiment som de refererer til, da, som der man har gitt gratis barnehage til noen område i tror det indre by i Chicago. Mm. Og så har man sett på de barna som da har gått på disse barnehagene, og så har man en kontrollgruppe med barn i tilsvarende område som ikke har gått på barnehage. Mm. Og så tester man barna for empati og vilje til å dele, og langt opp i skolealder, altså lenge etter at de var ferdige i barnehagen, så er det mulig å se forskjell på hvilke barn som har liksom blitt sosialisert inn i barnehagen med jevnaldrende barn tidlig. Jeg tror Kaplan sier at det med gratis eller barnehage til alle, det er vel det største tiltaket som SV kunne ha gjort for å skape et mer solidarisk, empatisk samfunn, at barn tidlig går i barnehagen. Så vi er formbare og plastiske, og derfor er det jo så viktig når man bygger et samfunn, da, at man tar utgangspunkt i ja, hvordan folk faktisk er. Da.
Men når vi snakker om oss selv som skapninger av evolusjon, så har vi en tendens til å fokusere på det negative. Vet jeg. Det er kanskje derfor Homo economicus har kommet og vunnet over Homo solidaricus i fremstillingen av oss, kanskje?
Ja, så, men det handler jo også om at altså når Adam Smith skrev da, om den usynlige hånd, og, så nå skal det jo sies at Adam Smith er jo både misforstått og misbrukt.
Ja, jeg tror Chomsky sa «He is to be worshipped, but never read».
Ja.
For jeg ble veldig overrasket når jeg leste Smith første gangen. Altså.
Så, Carly Hagen har jo skrevet den første og mest interessante av selvbiografiene sine, om Fremskrittspartiet, at han bestemte seg for å starte et parti bygd på de teoriene Edwin Smith fremmer i boka The Wealth of Nations, som jeg riktig nok aldri har lest.
Nei, akkurat.
Men uttalt meg om med så stor suffisianse at ingen noensinne har mistenkt at jeg ikke har lest boka grundig, tror jeg han skriver. Men han er nok ikke alene om det da. Men når Smith skrev Wealth of Nations, så var det jo pre-Darwin og pre alt det vi nå vet om hvordan folk faktisk er rigget.
Men han har noen sånne stikk der som jeg tror veldig mange av de som har skrevet det fælt han ikke er helt klar over. Sånn som for eksempel i dette frie markedet så er vi nødt til å regne med at rike folk rotter seg sammen og er konspiratoriske overfor resten av oss, for eksempel.
Absolutt. Det skjer ikke at ikke handelsfolk møtes uten at de snakker om hvor de skal snyte sine kunder eller noe sånt.
Men ikke sant?
Men han sier jo også at man er jo avhengig også av tillit i den type markedssamfunn, da, fordi at hvis du kjøper et brød, så må du stole på at bakeren selger et brød som veier like mye som det står på brødet, at det skal veie. Ikke sant? En hel masse sånne transaksjoner som foregår på markedet som er avhengig av en viss tillit mellom kjøper og selger, da.
Hvor havna nordmenn forresten på den testen du snakket om i sted? Dette her med deling, du snakket om en test. Da,
ja, nei, vi havner høyt oppe.
Ja.
Vi havner høyt oppe, og nordmenn skårer jo veldig høyt på tillit. Ja. Det som er litt fascinerende, det er jo at også norske, altså de områdene av USA, der det er mange med norsk og skandinavisk bakgrunn, også skårer høyt på dette med tillit. Så det er jo ikke bare et resultat av velferdsstat og så videre, men
en kultur som var satt før den utdanningen.
Ja, det er fascinerende det. Altså. Men vi har jo hvis man skal spekulere da, så er jo Norge et land med høye fjell og dype daler og karrige forhold da, ikke sant? Så det er jo lite grobunn for de store herregårder med Ridderborgen i midten og alle de livveggene rundt omkring. Sånn at, og vi fikk Svartedauden, ikke sant? Så var jo nesten tomt her. Så hvis naboen ble litt påtrengende, så var det jo bare å pakke opp og flytte til en ødegård, tre blå ned bort. Ikke sant?
Så landskapet har formet oss både evolusjonsmessig
ja, og kulturelt. Ja, altså jeg tror at hvordan hvilket landskap folk et land eller sånt skaper påvirker kulturen der, det er jo helt helt åpenbart. Mm. Så at folk i et karrig ørkenlandskap utvikler en annen type samfunn mm. enn mer fruktbare elvedaler liksom. Og vi hvis du ser tilbake til vikingene så var det jo man ble jo tatt til konge på en slags et slags demokratisk vis da. Mm. Og likte man ikke kongen så kvittet man seg med en da. Mm.
Ja, jeg har et spørsmål til Chris Dakesson det der etterpå, for han nevner jo den boka si at landskap hvor med irrigation disse områdene fremdeles mer urolige enn ja, andre områder fordi det har vært en ressurskamp langt tilbake så der også er jo der også er jo sånn at at landskapet har formet kulturen formet, ja,
det er lange linjer da jeg husker min reis en gang i fjernetiden studerte historie så fortalte en av lærerne om hvordan du kunne se linjer i norsk historie da, fra hvor sto tranitterbevegelsen steikt, hvor var det mange som stemte for republikk, hvor sto kommunistene sterkt. Altså det var liksom linjer i sånn, geografien i Norge da, som gikk over mange, mange generasjoner og sånt. Det er jo veldig fascinerende
at,
å se på.
Nå har han sagt at han er klar for å bli oppringt her, så da gjør vi det, tror jeg.
Så bra.
Skal vi se. Om dette funker, vi har et problem med wifi-nettverket her. Det så dårlig at jeg stoler ikke på PC-en, så vi må bruke telefonen. Så jeg håper det funker.
Vi krysser fingrene.
Der. Veldig mye lyd. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Nicholas. Can you hear me okay?
All right. Is your colleague joining us? Do you, or no?
No, he's already here.
I'm sitting right next to the phone here. Okay, so you're on the microphone. Okay.
Hi, Wegrand. Wegrand, how are you?
Almost.
Almost. Okay. You can call me Vegard. Vegard.
Vegard.
Vegard.
It says it's spelled here Wegrand. It's Vegard.
Yeah. Oh, it's Vegard. Okay. Yeah. Well, it's an old Norse name, so.
That's a great. I love those names. What does it mean?
It means guardian of the holy place.
Oh. That's a good name.
Yeah. It's
Vegard. Vegard, yeah.
Takes something living up to.
It sounds a lot more Vikingish than mine.
Yeah.
Both of your names sound Vikingish, actually. I have been to, God, I'm blocking the name right now. Famous Viking. I've been to Oslo. Yes. Yeah. I have not been to Norway. I'm sorry. This is awful.
I have been to Sweden.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Sorry. But one of my closest, a very good friend of mine, a colleague, she's a professor at the University of Oslo.
Okay.
Her name is Hope Jaren.
Okay.
And then I have another former colleague there. But I was going to say I've been to Lanso Meadows, the Viking settlement.
Yeah, in Newfoundland.
Yes, it's incredible.
Yeah, no, the Swedes are softies.
Well, those guys were Norwegian, you know that. Yeah. The Vikings colonizing Vinland, they were Norwegians. No Swedes.
Yes, I know. Yeah. I know. We've been to the Vundestrands, you know, the long beaches that they described in the legends before they got to Lanso Meadows. It's incredible, actually, the site.
Yeah. It is.
Anyway.
Yeah. haven't been there.
Okay, so we set the goal then. Thank you so much for setting aside some time for us.
I'm very grateful to be here. Thank you for having me.
I'm happy that you've been on some minor podcasts like Joe Rogan and Yasha Monk to prepare for this one.
They were both interesting experiences, but those podcasts were not with the descendants of Vikings, so far as I know. So that's fine.
That's true. That's true. I mean, it's probably safer for us to be at a distance from each other.
Yeah, we'll be gentle.
We just spent about 15 minutes talking about Vegard's book, which is called Homo Solidaricus, and I guess it's a mini version of your book, where they argue that cooperation is within us from evolution.
Yeah.
And that social democracy is kind of a state of nature, I guess you could say.
It is. To put it briefly, me and my co-author have looked on a lot of the same research that you draw upon, just to state that humans are wired for cooperation and solidarity, and we try to argue against the thesis that we are all homo economicus, selfish, and trying to gain advantages for ourselves in everything we do. We wrote that book before your last book came out, and of course there's a lot of things that you write about that we probably would have drawn upon in our book as well. But I think we can say that there's a lot of books, there's a lot of research the last 10, 20, 30 years that are pointing in the same direction. And this is a paradigm shift in how people look upon humans and the way we make society.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that, of course. You know, I think for too long, in my view, both evolutionary biologists and social scientists and, you know, citizens in the street have been overly focused on the dark side of human nature, on our evolutionary capacity for selfishness and cruelty and mendacity and violence. And I think the bright side has been denied the attention it deserves, because equally we are endowed with capacities for love and friendship and cooperation and teaching. And I would furthermore argue that these positive qualities are necessarily more powerful than these negative qualities, because in fact, if every time I came near you, you were mean to me, or you lied to me, you told me false information about the environment, or killed me, then I would be better off living apart from you. We would be a species that lived atomistically, separated from one another. We would be a solitary species, but that's not the kind of species we are. Therefore, I think it's quite plain that the benefits of a connected life have outweighed the costs, and we have evolved, although we have these capacities for selfishness and violence and cruelty, we have evolved nevertheless primarily to be a cooperative and kind species overall. So I quite share your perspective, your collective and optimistic perspective.
Yeah. Like you learned in the beginning here, I'm a social democrat, and if not directly conclude that social democracy is the best, the natural way of organizing a society. We also share, me and my co-authors share a frustration on how the whole left side of politics have shunned everything connected to biology.
Yes.
Which is
like the analog to the right, you know, shunning everything to do with climate science.
Yeah.
Or in our country, you know, the right refuses to look at gun violence. You know, we just had this incredible event where after 20 years, the federal government finally gave just $50 million to support research into the epidemiology of gun violence. So I think the far right and the far left both have their pet things that they ignore. And on the left, as you're suggesting, there's a lot of fear, needless fear, in my view, of evolutionary biology.
Yeah.
Before I ask you a question about that, could we do a little bit more on the book specifically to get people started.
But before I go to that, I just wanted to comment on Vegard's comment about social democracy. I mean, I would like to say that I think that at least what I'm writing about is the way in which human beings have been endowed with certain capacities, and all of my arguments relate to the long arc of our evolution going back hundreds of thousands of years, and they could all be applied to human beings before history and before substantial technology. So they, before politics, they could all be applied to human beings as they lived 10,000 years ago. Now, of course, in the last 10,000 years, a lot else has happened to our species. We could talk about that too. But I just would say that I can imagine a number of political systems that are compatible with our inborn capacities. Although I would agree that a social democratic political system, at least superficially, would play to our strengths, would play to our sort of inborn tendencies.
Mm. Well, there we go. Then we all know what to vote for next
time. Yeah. Of course, if you say that there are no such thing as a society, like Margaret Thatcher.
No,
said,
no, that's not true.
Yeah, that's plain wrong, isn't it?
Yes. No. We are not an anarchical species. Not at all. We evolved to be organized in very particular ways. And one of the clues to that is, for example, just to jump into a little one specific fact, we humans are incredibly unusual. Well, just to back up even further, we share with all other animals an interest in and in a capacity to form to mate with each other. We are sexually reproducing species, but we don't just mate with each other; we befriend each other. Mm. We form long-term non-reproductive unions to other unrelated members of our species, namely we have friends. And this is exceedingly rare in the animal kingdom. We do it, certain other primates do it, elephants do it, and certain cetacean species do it, certain whale species. But the reason I'm bringing up this specific example is that, amazingly, if you go and you study friendship, for example, in elephants, and our last common ancestor with elephants was 85 million years ago, you map the structure of the networks that those elephant friendships give rise to, and you map the structure of the networks that human friendships give rise to, those structures are very similar mathematically. Hmm. And what's interesting about that is that it suggests, or it strongly suggests, that or strong evidence in favor of the claim that evolution has shaped our social order, if it's achieved the same outcome in us as in elephants by convergent evolution. So there are certain aspects of how we organize ourselves that are very innate, and this innateness is proven by the coincident emergence of an analogous property in a completely different species, namely elephants. So yes, there are some fundamental ways that we have evolved to relate to each other that lie at the core, that prove that we are not a solitary species. We necessarily are developed for social life.
Yeah, and you write about how the evolutionary pressure of living among people is at least equal or even means more than the evolutionary pressure of avoiding predators. And that was quite interesting.
Yeah, I think the main killer of ancient human beings was other human beings. So evolving the capacity to live with other humans was vastly more important than evolving the capacity to, avoid lions. Mm. We had very few, if any, natural predators. So this was the challenge for our species, was to figure out a way to basically live together. And we have been, therefore, over the course of the long sweep of our evolution, been endowed with these various capacities to do that.
I have a question about the nature-nurture debate, actually, as long as we are way back in the past, because when people say that we are kind of shaped by culture, it feels to me as a layman that they tend to forget that our cultures are built upon nature, because we started as animals and we came out of that. So our cultural and social systems are kind of a result of evolution too, aren't they?
Absolutely. And one of the most amazing things is that even our capacity. So first of all, I think it's very important to avoid these sort of false dichotomies between nature and nurture. I think it's almost always both in almost every outcome that you might be interested in. Yeah. But as you're suggesting, it's important to realize that our very capacity for culture is itself a product of our evolution. So culture depends upon our capacity to learn from each other and teach each other things. Now, if I might just take a moment to digress, because it's important.
Yep.
So many animals can learn, almost every animal can learn. A little fish swimming in the sea can learn that if it swims up to the light, it will find food there. This is a kind of independent learning. Some animals, you can learn socially, and learning socially is incredibly efficient. So for example, you can learn independently. You put your hand in the fire and you burn your hand and you learn that it burns. So you've acquired some knowledge, namely fire burns, and you've paid some price, namely you've burned your hand. Or I can watch you put your hand in the fire and I get almost as much knowledge and I pay none of the price. Mm. This is incredibly efficient. Social learning by observing other members of our species is incredibly efficient. And, for example, I could watch you eat the red berries and you die. Mm. Now you pay a huge price for that. And I can just say, hey, I better not eat red berries. And that's incredible. Mm. Now, many fewer species learn socially. Some we do and others do, but we do something that's even more amazing. And that's very rare in the animal kingdom, which is that we teach each other things. We set about to teach each other how to build a fire, for example. And this capacity for teaching and social learning lies at the core of our capacity for culture, which is the ability to transmit knowledge across space and time so that when I learn something independently, I can transmit it to you, or I can transmit it to my descendants, and knowledge accumulates across time. Mm. And this is what makes us a cultural animal, and which in turn further shapes our evolutionary trajectory.
Yeah, because when people argue too strongly for the social constructivist view, I think they start this history at the kind of a point that it's advantageous to that argument, and they forget the beginning.
Mm.
But as Vegard said, he is frustrated with the left and their unwillingness to take all this in. Yeah. And I share that frustration.
I think just to comment further on that, I think it's because from Darwin and Spencer and the social Darwinism, the survival of the fittest, the survival of the strongest, biology and genes have been used to further more a political agenda where it's okay to have very poor people and very rich people, because Darwin and survival of the fittest. And if you watch Wall Street, the first one with Michael Douglas ranting about greed. Mm. Greed is good. Greed is something that's built into us by evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And because of and also a fear that if we acknowledge the role that genes play, we also tend to that we are preordained to a certain point and status in society, and the left has always wanted to believe that people can create their own destiny, and if genes play too big a part, I think that's part of the reason why people on the left have been afraid to look into the genes, what we might find there. But when you look at it into it and you look into the research that you and other evolutionary biologists and so and economists during the last decades have found that people are not like that at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is absolutely the case that some scientific theories and discoveries have been used as, frankly, any scientific technology can be open, any science or technology can be open to abuse, have been used in ways that are pernicious or immoral. But I don't think the solution is to throw away this either science or scientific facts. I think much better to accept the facts and then argue, join each other with an optimal understanding of the structure of the world. In other words, try to see the world as it is, not as we wish it to be. Yeah. And then we can discuss how we are going to act given what we observe. And so I think that the desire to, like, you know, for example, on the right, we see people, they don't want to believe in climate science because they don't want necessarily to do what it would take to respond to it. Well, the proper way to cope with that is not to say, let's put our head in the sand and ignore the scientific reality. The proper way to say is, well, let's do the science, and then we can debate among ourselves how to respond to this reality. So we might conclude, for example, that nature does equip our species, like other species, to have some inequality. But we can decide as a society that actually we're going to redress that inequality. We're going to, correct the natural lottery using social policies or not. We might decide not to, whatever. But the point is, at least we would be having the debate on the basis of ideology. But I also want to just say that, as I argue in the book later on, I think much more damage has been done and more people have died because of a false belief in the sociological mutability of human beings than because of a belief in the genetic immutability. So we have had many, many leaders, for example, Pol Pot, that believe that, oh, I'll just prescribe how people will live. Yeah. And, you know, millions of people die as a result. I'm much more in favor of a kind of organic social organization where we create the circumstances in which people can naturally express the kind of happy social arrangements that we have evolved to have.
Yeah.
Rather than trying to engineer, you know, some kind of social order where I think inevitably we wind up harming more people than we benefit.
Yeah, and you don't have to go to genocidal regimes to find those problems. I mean, there's one sentence in your book that really leapt off the page for me, and that's right at the end where you say that we should be humble in the face of temptations to engineer society in opposition to our instincts. That worries me to a very large extent, and it seems to me that there's a bit of that around now, even though it's not at Pol Pot level.
Yes.
Can you expand on that, the dangers of trying to force things through?
Yeah, I mean, maybe with a metaphor might be helpful. So, imagine that you want to, you know, you're not happy with the size of your feet. The size of human feet, and so you decide to bind the feet, to give people small feet, or imagine that you're not happy with the length of your neck, so you decide to add rings around your neck to lengthen your neck, or you decide, as in some South American prehistoric South American cultures, that you're not happy with the shape of your skulls. You think that a more pleasing shape is like a boat, so you need to bind babies' heads to deform their skulls to give them this long thing, or imagine that you decide that that you don't like the size of your breasts and that, you know, everyone's breasts should be a different size. There are all these ways in which you can imagine cultural norms impinging upon our bodies and maybe making us less healthy.
Yeah.
And I mean, I've chosen some provocative and widespread examples from every continent deliberately and every era, including our own. But those efforts and those desires might not necessarily lead to optimal human flourishing. you know, there's a kind of natural way in which our bodies have evolved to function and be. Now, I'm not saying, just to be very clear, I'm not saying that anything natural is good, a kind of naturalistic fallacy. For example, maternal death during childbearing is natural, but that's awful. We would absolutely not want, you know, we would save women's lives if they're dying while delivering a baby. I'm not arguing against modern medicine by any stretch of the imagination. I am a doctor. I believe in the benefits of medicine and in technology and so forth. But I am saying we should be humble and careful when we mess with the kind of ways in which our bodies have, let's say, evolved to be. So, and this also comes up, for example, you know, with more extreme examples like the application of CRISPR technology in that recent case in China, where, you know, the scientists thought that he could use this technology just to edit the HIV related genes, but actually, as could easily have been predicted, this is a loose cannon in the genome, and there are now many mutations in these two children throughout their genome, not just in the targeted region, you know, that he's made these humans with the edited genes. Anyway, that's analogously, we should also be humble and careful with our efforts to engineer social order. There is a sense in which we have some innate capacities for living together, and I think we should be rather wary of it. So I'll give you one example of this. For many totalitarian states, friendship between people is a threat because you're supposed to owe your allegiance to the leader or to the ideology and not to your intimate social relations like your friends. So, for example, the Stasi in East Germany was very eager to make people suspicious of each other so you wouldn't know who to trust. You wouldn't be able to trust your friends. You would be more isolated. You should put your confidence in the state. Now, a huge pressure was required to suppress our innate interest in forming friendships. And it worked for a while, but it cannot work forever. You cannot suppress these innate tendencies in human beings forever. And I give many examples of this in the book, not just with respect to friendship, but also with respect to other innate tendencies, like, for instance, the universal human interest in love. And so anyway, so yes, I second what you said. I do not think we can engineer any old social order we want any more than we can engineer any old body we want.
I guess one of the most flammable things to talk about there is gender-based division of labor. You have a couple of examples of that too, like the kibbutzes, for example.
Yeah, and I think there is a division of labor in every society. Now, it's not, and it's usually gendered. However, what counts as male and female work can vary substantially across society. So, for example, things that count as male work in one society could count as female work in another society. For example, tending large animals. In some societies, tending large animals is men's work. In other societies, it's women's work. But there are certain relative universals. For example, childcare is much more oftenly seen as women's work across societies. And, you know, warfare is much more often seen as male. Now, these are not always the case, but this is, you know, very typical cross-culturally. So yeah, there is generally a gender division of labor in any society, and there can be some patterns across societies, but there also are substantial differences, as I've just summarized.
I think probably in the international discussion about things, this is the topic where Sweden and Norway is most often mentioned, I think, because of the gender paradox thing.
It's an astonishing thing that in your societies, which I personally hold in such high regard, where people are maximally free to live lives as they wish for various reasons, including your political system, your relative wealth, your tradition of stability and civil discourse and so forth, often the women choose and the men choose very gender stereotypic things to do, which I think is terrific. I mean, I think that's most consistent with human flourishing. You know, you have more female engineers in Albania than you do in Sweden, proportionately. And we would not ever believe that women are more free in Albania than in Sweden or Norway.
Yeah, this is one example where we try to, I think, socially construct systems that kind of swim against our evolution in certain ways.
No, no, no. They're not quite the opposite. They're okay. Swimming with evolution. So what you're doing is you're constructing systems that allow people to express whatever their innate desires and tendencies are.
Oh, yeah. So I meant the opposite, actually. I meant these efforts to have 50-50 gendered workforces.
Well, no, I would. Yeah, I would not. So I don't think that 50-50, you do not want to engineer 50-50 for anything. That would not make any sense as far as I'm concerned. What you do want is a system that absolutely does not discriminate. Mm. So you want systems that do not prejudge people based on their gender, and you want systems that don't discriminate against anybody based on their gender, but you want systems that allow people to be free. And if they choose, freely choose to do one thing or another thing, well, I think that's terrific.
Yeah. Sounds social democratic too.
It does. I would like to, we have been reflecting, me and my co-author, a bit about this friendship thing because, and culture, because you have to apply not only North Korea or China to have a functioning bureaucracy, a functioning market economy. You have to have layers and layers of culture to keep people from giving advantages to their friends. So the natural tendency is when your friend apply for a grant or apply for a permit and you work in the county, the natural tendency is, of course, to grant a favor to your friend. But that's illegal. Yeah.
Yes.
And so we have layers and layers of culture to keep the state neutral, to keep the bureaucracy neutral, to treat people equally, independently of friendship and their social network. But that's a bit of social engineering as well.
Yes, well, keep in mind that, yes, first of all, I would totally second what you said. We do not want, we absolutely want to allow you to do favors for your friends that are your own to grant. And in fact, that is the key part of friendship, is the unreciprocated giving between individuals, or the giving without expectation of immediate reciprocation is a cardinal feature of friendship. But not by applying favors of the state or the bureaucracy. So clearly we don't want that.
Or the business you're running? Or
well, no, the business, I mean, if it's your own business, you should be allowed to hire your friends to work there. Mm. That's different, right? That's your business. It just the way that you can give a gift to your friend, and we would think that's normal. So I think things that belong to you and are yours, I think you can share with your friends. I think that's innate. That's what humans have done since time immemorial. But applying the power of the state, that's like I'm giving something of yours to my friend. Mm. You know, your tax hour. That's different. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, but at least that's my opinion. And I also think that would be attempting to prevent people from giving jobs to their own friends if they own the firm, if it's their own firm. I would regard that as social engineering, not in keeping with our nature, for example. But my point, though, is that all of the examples we're discussing are examples that explore the application of our innate capacities and tendencies in the setting of modernity. And it's very important to recognize that, at least from my point of view, the things that I'm discussing are things that we evolved to have and are relevant to how we organize ourselves before the invention of agriculture, before the invention of cities, before the invention of nation states, before the invention of telecommunications. So all of these other things might not necessarily in and of themselves have a terrific fit with our innate capacity. So for example, when it comes again to use the metaphor of our bodies, you know, we evolved to like sweet and salty things. Those were very scarce in our ancestral environment and very useful to our bodies. So we acquired the taste. When you found something sweet or fatty, you wanted it. That was good for you to eat a lot of that. Yeah. But now in our time of abundance, those desires are not in the environment we have modified and created for ourselves. those desires are not necessarily ideal. So in your example of the firm, it might be the case that it's natural for us to want to do favors for our friends. It is the case. But we now have created an economy that, let's say, involves businesses and firms, which is not the feature of our ancestral environment. So you and I might debate that a little bit. Like now, as I'm talking to you, I'm wondering, gee, you know, my initial thought was that if the state actor, you know, if you're an employee of the state, you cannot preferentially give jobs to your friends, but if it's your own firm, you should. Now I'm thinking, well, maybe you shouldn't. I have to think about that some more, you know. But I can certainly say it's a natural desire.
Mm. Of course it is. I think it's Jared Diamond who writes about in The World Before Yesterday how people from tribal societies, I think in Eugenia or something, have developed, as you say, at certain times of the year, they have access to certain kinds of food, and they gorge themselves with sweetened salt and fatty food, and they meet our modern society where you have access to all that food all the time, and they're not culturally equipped to handle that, and they end up with obese and with heart diseases and diabetes and so
An example, other many examples of this are, is that many of the classic phobias that humans have, for example, of snakes or of high places,
spiders, or of
small confined spaces. Yeah. You know, you have agoraphobia or claustrophobia, or any of these phobias that human beings have. Are all phobias that were highly relevant to our survival in the ancestral environment, where it made sense to be afraid of snakes or high places or tiny caves or whatever. But what we really need in the modern environment is phobia of guns, or of loose carpets. You know, many elderly people die because they trip over loose carpets. But it will take a few centuries before we develop those phobias. You know, I think you see all these cases of children in the United States where they find their parents' guns and then they kill their siblings. And you better believe that a mutation that made it so that we were afraid of guns, the little children were afraid of guns the way they're afraid of snakes, naturally, eventually such a mutation would spread in the population so that 10,000 years from now, or more, maybe 100,000 anyway, in that range, there would be a uniform, people would be, the prevalence of gun, fear of guns would be similar to the prevalence of fear of snakes. Yes, I think the modern environment.
That would take some time, wouldn't it?
It does take time. It does take time, but not, you know, I would think it takes order 10,000 years. I mean, one of my favorite examples of this, which is discussed in the book, is the evolution of, which is very common in Norway and in Sweden, is the capacity to digest milk as an adult.
Yeah.
And so this is a fantastic example. It's one of our best worked out examples of some of the topic we're on right now, which is the topic of gene culture coevolution. So the primary sugar in milk is a sugar called lactose. And we have an enzyme in our body called lactase that digests that sugar. And in the ancestral environment, you know, before 10,000 years ago, human beings express this enzyme only during infancy. So you suckled at your mother's breast and you drank milk, and you needed to digest the sugar in the milk, and so you had lactase in your body, in your intestinal tract, and then when you were weaned, you no longer expressed lactase in your body because you didn't need to. You would never drink milk again. And why would you never drink milk again? Because there was no milk in the environment. Only babies drank milk, their mother's milk, and there was no other milk anywhere that anybody would drink prior to 10,000 years ago. And that's why no adults prior to 10,000 years ago, basically, had the capacity to digest milk in adulthood. Hmm. And then what happened? Well, on multiple occasions between 3,000 and 9,000 years ago, human beings domesticated milk-producing animals. We had a cultural or technological innovation or innovations that allowed us to domesticate animals and take care of them. Milk-producing animals like sheep and goats and camels and cows and so forth. And now all of a sudden, because of something we did to our environment, there was milk in the environment. So animal milk, so that human beings whose lactase persisted into adulthood now suddenly had an advantage compared to human beings who didn't have those mutations. We could have another source of food, namely milk that other humans in our neighborhood couldn't use. Or we could have a source of hydration, which we could drink when the water was spoiled. Everyone else was drinking, you know, contaminated water, but we were drinking milk, which was very healthy, useful for us. So because of this change in our environment, the mutation that allowed us to digest milk was advantageous and spread through the human population, such that now roughly half the global population can digest milk into adulthood. And what's amazing about this is that it's something we humans have done. We have acted on our environment, and it has changed the course of our evolution, such that now we have different kinds of genes than we would have had we not done this thing. So I think the invention of guns, and that example worked between multiple times between 3,000 and 9,000 years ago. And so I think the example of the invention of guns over a similar time span, you know, 10,000 year time span, might have a similar impact, such that people who, let's say, had a natural fear of guns out survived those who did not.
Yeah, that sounds like, we have an example of this in my family, actually. We are a family of four, and our youngest boy is adopted from the Philippines, and he can't drink milk. He's the only one in our family who can't. there's a miniature example.
Hmm. Yes, actually, we have an adopted child as well, and he also can't drink milk.
There you go. So how much time do you have, by the way, Niklas?
I had set aside another 15 minutes till 1 o'clock ahead of schedule.
So we have to talk about groupishness then. Because that's a large part of your book, and it's a large part of Vegard's book. How to define groups and how can they work together? Because this seems to me to be a very important question these days. I sent you an email where we said that we're just a few days out from the English election, British election, which again is a shock to, well, especially people on the left, I think, social democrats.
Not a shock, to me.
Okay.
I was expecting that.
Okay. That big in Atlantic? Okay.
This is another subject, but I know something about the people behind the Boris Johnson campaign, and they are really, really good at campaigns, and they have been targeting with laser-like precision those constituencies that they needed to win for the Tory, and
like Trump did with the blue wall.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go ahead.
I mean, I was surprised. Maybe I'm politically more naive, only because I had thought Brexit is such a plainly stupid thing that I had thought that if they had a second referendum, you know, the young are against Brexit. I felt like they would have aged into voting age. Many of the people supporting it were older. They literally will have died in the last 4 years. Plus, all the debate about it would have shown how costly it was and how the alleged advantages, like the NHS improvements, were false. And I thought if they had a second referendum, which is what I thought they should do, they would have changed their minds about Brexit and it would have ended it.
Well,
and I had other peers of mine who said, no, the majority of Brits actually are in favor of Brexit. And to which my response was, if that's the case, then I believe in democracy. Then, you know, we have to respect that. Even if people want, you know, that's, even if it's, in my opinion, it's stupid, but that's what the majority wants. So be it.
I think groupishness.
We had two.
Well, no, I was just going to say on the political topic. So on the Brexit issue. So, it is related to groupishness, and I know we're taking it in a slightly different direction. But so I was, unlike Vegard, I was surprised by the outcome, because I thought that the majority was against it, but they're not. But he did exactly what Vegard suggested. Johnson has been able, in my view, to kind of defang, to like give he's able to be kind of center right, which I think is a very effective. And I'm very worried about the left moving too far left, because I don't think you can win elections that way. And at least in the United States, I see a lot of you know, causes that are very popular on the far left, which are just not going to win elections. And I think what Johnson has done is he's been able to sort of keep the right voting for him, but without moving so far to the right.
Yeah, I think Yasha Monk, who has been mentioned here, actually he tweeted a repetition of one sentence after this election, where he said that right populism always wins over left populism. Right populism always wins over left populism. And he kept repeating that. And I think it's correct, actually, as evidence shows.
I'm not familiar. I don't. My political science and politics are not good enough to understand. Why is that? I believe that that's a true observation, but what's the explanation for that? I don't know the answer to that.
Well, I think if you go into this groupishness question, have you heard the somewheres anywheres debate? People.
No, I'm not sure. Yeah.
Okay, so this is an idea about how people function. Actually, that some people are.
Oh, that they want to believe they belong somewhere rather than everywhere.
Absolutely, yes.
Yes.
And the author of this idea says that there are probably more people who are somewheres than anywheres.
Yes.
And again, this goes into groupishness, because a lot of people, especially on the left, I think, keep focusing on economics when they try mm-hmm. to explain to people how stupid Brexit is. But mm-hmm. If you ask actually somewheres, if that's what you want to call them, who are mm-hmm. Brexiteers, they say that they will take a haircut loss on economics to mm-hmm. keep control of their kind of culture, their kind of group, more or less, their country. So groupishness is a very big thing in that election and in the Brexit debate.
Well, yeah, I think that's exactly right. But what's interesting to me about that argument is that it's sort of at odds a little bit with another classic properly left-wing concern, which is the right often says, you know, if we have an efficient economy, capital and labor will move to where it's more efficiently applied, and isn't that great? But the problem is people at the lower end of the economic distribution, the poor, they rely on a network of friends to provide services that the rich buy in the market. Mm. So, for example, you and I, you know, when we have problems, let's say we might pay a therapist to listen to us. Or if our car breaks down, we take it to a mechanic and we pay the mechanic in cash to fix our car. Or if we need childcare, we buy childcare on the open market, we hire a provider. But for poor people, they rely on a network of friends and family to provide these services. So they have a friend who can come over and watch their children, or they have a friend who provides a car repair at a low price and so forth. And those are not movable. Mm. So I can move anywhere in the United States because I don't really need a local network of friends and family to live my life. Mm. I just buy those services on the open market. But if you're poor, you can't. So this is where the right wing often, in my view, is very misunderstands this. In other words, this claim that, oh, well, we'll close the factory here and people can just move. Mm. They can't move.
No, that's true.
Their whole lives are connected because they live in a different way, you see, and in some ways in a more natural way, you know, relying on their networks of friends.
And so what Espen is alluding to here is that also a part of the political elite on the left side of politics are more defining themselves as anywheres,
yes,
more than somewheres, and the British election is a prime example of that.
Mm. And it turns out large parts of the labor class is somewheres.
I saw actually the election broken down on the basis of education. Mm. And the propensity for voting Tory was way higher among people with no education. Low-skilled, working-class people voted Tory. Mm. But among the higher educated, a large majority voted for Labour. And that is really food for thought for a party calling themselves Labour and are attempting
to. I think the British election, I mean, the British election had, I mean, honestly, they were both lousy choices, you know, and I don't, And I don't understand why the Labour Party immolated, self-immolated. I mean, the internal politics were such they couldn't have replaced Corbyn, but my God, they should have. Mm. I mean, it was a catastrophic loss. And, I also see that now in the United States. You know, people are looking, in my view, correctly at electability, you know, of all these candidates on the left. Who can beat Trump? That's the question. Yeah. It might not be the, let's say, the ideal candidate, let's say, from the point of view of, whatever agenda, political agenda. But, you know, I think electability is crucial. And so why didn't happen with Corbyn, I don't know. I mean, he was not going to do well.
Yeah. I have a question specifically to this about groupishness, because there's another sentence that keeps repeating. Paul Collier keeps repeating the sentence that culture trumps economics. And I think it's right. And that's about groupishness. So I think
I was very flattered to see in the Times Literary Supplement that Sir Paul named my book his favorite book of the year in 2019.
Uh-huh. Yeah, uh-huh. I believe.
Very nice.
Yeah. Yeah, he's brilliant, and he keeps talking about this, and that's proof, I think, that groupishness is the thing to watch here, and not economics, actually, because our parties were made in a time where economic groups were kind of the order of the day. And now we have different questions, and all these parties, they keep flailing around to find out what they actually feel about these things, because especially with globalization and with immigration, this groupishness, this togetherness is being challenged in a new way, and it now means a lot more. So it feels like the groups that have been constructed on the national level are being challenged. That groupishness is being challenged, both from within, with identity politics, as the left is so fond of these days.
Yes.
And from without, on the global and internationalization level. So these groups that have been there for quite a long time, they are now being challenged in different ways, and people kind of feel that these connections are withering on the group level. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I don't think there's no end to groupishness in human beings. I mean, as I discussed in the book, there are all these classic experiments. You know, you can just randomly assign babies different t-shirt colors, you know, yellow and green t-shirts, and that trivial intervention of a random assignment of a t-shirt color, the children will suddenly believe that the children of the opposite t-shirt color are awful children. You know, they deserve to be punished, and no toy should be given to those children. Yeah. Just, and even though the kids know that they did nothing to deserve these colors and that they were chance assignments, they understand that. They nevertheless form this opinion based on this minimal group, so-called minimal group assignment. So people are very groupish, innately so, and it's very a depressing observation. So I don't think groupishness is going away, but I do agree that the axes or the kinds of groups being defined may be changing. And
it's confusing to people.
Yes.
Because you write about one of these constructed societies that people, they kind of created these small societies because they were after something authentic. They were after authenticity.
And yes.
They could find that in small groups. And I think that's what's lacking when these groups keep changing. And internationalization is kind of Gesellschaft on steroids, I guess you could say. And things kind of melt into air, I think.
Yes. Hmm. Well, groupishness, in at least to a native speaker, groupishness is means sort of clannishness. It means like liking your own group in preference to others. You're now talking about another kind of groupishness, or I would say groupiness would probably be the word versus groupishness. Mm-hmm. And groupiness would be the interest that human beings have to live in groups of face-to-face communities. And I think there's enough economic, at least in the United States, maybe in Scandinavia as well, there's enough economic disruption, enough maybe immigration concern, globalization concern. I think we may see another generational rise in communitarian movements where people set up communes and try to live apart from the rest of society, try to live a more wholesome way, or a way they perceive as more wholesome. And every 30 years or so, there's been a spike in the United States in such living arrangements. And I think we may be seeing that again in the United States, at least.
Yeah, probably. Mm. Yeah, that's very interesting part of your book, to see what triggers that kind of building of communes.
Yes.
Yeah. So I think the problem is, to quote Sir Paul again, then he also keeps saying that there has to be a we. We need a we. And that's the problem these days, because just defining a we is also an exclusionary thing to do. And we shouldn't exclude anybody. But if you include everybody, it's always difficult to find the we, isn't it?
Yeah, but there's always going to be some boundary. I mean, I think that you can speak of we as the whole of the human species, but that's not very natural to us. You know, we, as I said, are very natural. But here's the important distinction. One of the things that has depressed me the most about our species is why can't we love our own groups without hating other groups? Yeah. I mean, why can't we just be neutral about other groups? You know, like, let's agree or understand that it's in our nature to make groups and love our own groups. Okay, fine. But why do we have to think ill of other groups? You know, why could we just say, oh, they're different?
I also think that trying to define that in-group leads to people suspecting you hating the out-group. I read Amy Shua's last book on political tribes.
Yeah.
And she quoted that most reviled of all creatures, the Trump voter, who
was
interviewed, and he said that, I lock the door in my house not because I hate what's outside, but because I love what's inside.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's a suspicion there. So once you start defining groups, you're always... people suspect that you hate everybody else. It's a frustrating discourse these days.
Yes, that's exactly right. Mm.
Just one more question before we round up here. Do you know the work of David Sloan Wilson? That you have natural selection not only between individuals, but between groups, where you have kind of super organisms. That you have society or groups that evolve and competing against each other.
Yes.
He said egoism beats altruism within a group. Altruistic groups beats egoistical groups. Everything else is comments. Do you think this is a phenomenon that super organisms, group societies evolve?
I mean, this is a very contentious area of science. I think there's some evidence for, you're opening up a whole other topic. So first of all, the best way to refer to this is multi-level selection, not group selection. I think that, and I talk a little bit about the book and about competition between groups and how that might affect the internal dynamics. I think there's no question that there can be cultural group selection. So groups that culturally express certain traits can outperform groups that express other traits. For example, this is one of the arguments that Joe Henrich and others have offered regarding the ascendancy of monogamy. You know, why one of the reasons that monogamy spread around the world is that groups that had the norm of monogamy internally had less conflict internally and therefore were more effective at fighting against groups that did not have that norm, for example.
That's a different
operating on a cultural level is, I think there's a lot of evidence for group selection operating at a cultural level. Operating on a genetic level is much more difficult. Some of the work we do in my lab provides evidence for this idea. For example, we've been able to provide evidence that that the friends you pick affect your ability to survive. And to the extent that that's the case, it gives evolution a lever to work not just on individuals, but on collections of individuals. In other words, if your Darwinian fitness depends upon who is around you, then people's self-assembly into groups of friends with particular properties, any genetics qualities that endow them with a capacity to do that, then all of a sudden we have a lever for natural selection to work to shape the structure of groups. So I think there's some evidence for this, but I think we're far from, and I think individual selection is still the dominant force, but I think we're far from being able to, you know, definitively explain what role, if any, this plays in human affairs.
Yeah, okay. Anything else we should say before we have to wrap up? Because
Thank you so much for your interest and for this in Blueprint, and thank you also for your wonderful conversation, which I greatly enjoyed.
And there was no talk about Halloween costumes.
No, not at all.
Thank God.
I like you two guys defending evolution because it has been given a bad rap. And people have these bad feelings about evolution because the bad rap that it has been given. It reminds me actually of something Gandhi once apparently said. He was asked, how can you be so positive after reading books on history? And he said that we have to remember that history is actually the written record of every breakdown in the steady workings of love. And I think our negative focus on evolution has kind of done the same thing with that idea.
Thank you both.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
All right, bye-bye.
Ja, interessant. Ja, den timen gikk alt for fort.
Det gjorde det også.
Jeg hadde... jeg tar forresten opp forløpig, fremdeles. Bare jeg hadde veldig mye mer å snakke med noen groupishness. Det var liksom det jeg hadde mest lyst til å prate om. Nivåene, hvor er vi... For Sir Paul har jeg helt rett når han sier at vi trenger et vi. Ja. Men vi sliter veldig, veldig med å definere det vi-et. Mm. Fordi med en gang man definerer et vi, så ekskluderer man, og da blir man... jakta ned, for å si sånn. Så den, akkurat den der identitetskrisa som kan dukke opp både på nasjonalt nivå og alt mulig annet, ved at vi ikke klarer å definere det vi, det et kjempeproblem. Og jeg helt overbevist om at Brexit og det valget bort i England, og også veldig mange andre valg, en reaksjon på akkurat den greia der. Og vi kan snakke om økonomi, men det
holder. Det kjempesønn, men det var jo... meget interessante ting han hadde med, og det en bok som alle som opptatt av disse tingene, og som selvsagt allerede har lest Homo Soldaticus, nå bør gyver døs på Blueprint. Det var mye jeg også hadde lyst til å høre han utdype. Han skriver fantastisk fascinerende om skibbruddene.
Ja, de er veldig fine.
Hvordan
for de som ikke har lest boka, så når han beskriver fordelene ved samarbeid, så går han gjennom en voldsom mengde med skibsbrudd. Folk som blir strandet på øyer, og hva som er suksesselementene i det å overleve etter å ha blitt strandet. Og det å samarbeide, det er nøkkelen.
Hva som gjør at noen overlever og tar seg trygt tilbake etter år på en øde øye, mens andre dør etter at alle har spist opp hverandre nærmest.
Ja. Den boka her, og måten han prater om dette på, og denne kunnskapen og dybden i alt dette her, gjør at jeg har lyst til å sparke en liberalist i rumpa. Ja. Fordi liberalister har en tendens til å beskrive seg selv som veldig dype og tankefulle. Men for meg er det en utrolig lakkdyp forståelse av hvordan samfunnet funker. For dette her er svære, svære, store krefter.
Og det vi heller ikke, som jeg hadde hatt lyst til å spørre han om, det er hvordan de tingene han skriver om menneskenaturen bør innvirke på hvordan vi innretter arbeidsliv, for eksempel. Hva er det som driver oss i et arbeidsfellesskap? Den store debatten.
Hvor viktig er det å ha meningsfullt arbeid? Det veldig ikke aktuelt sant? Akkurat.
Hva er det som motiverer oss til å jobbe, for eksempel? Altså, vi har jo den store debatten om New Public Management, som har dukket opp igjen etter at Jonas Gahr Støre varslet et oppgjør med, et betimelig oppgjør med New Public Management. Som,
et oppgjør som skulle kommet for lenge siden, på bred front.
Ja, men det er også Homo Economicus som satt i system.
Et sterkt mantra, det der. Altså.
Med telekanter og kontroll, og lite tillit til hva.
Ikke bare sånn økonomisk, men også på betydningen av hva meningsfullt arbeid faktisk er. For det også tror jeg er under ganske hardt angrep i et sånt rigid New Public Management system, liksom. Administrasjon og den type oppgaver som egentlig ikke er den givende delen. Og jeg har hatt mannsforum her for en stund siden. Det er brennbart bare å snakke med mannsforum. Spesielt viktig, viser det seg I alle undersøkelser for menn.
Ja.
Å ha meningsfylt arbeid. De legger mye mer vekt på det når de blir spurt hva som greia. Dette en utfordring fremover.
Man finner tilfredsstillelse I jobben sin.
Og dette kommer med samme automatiseringen og noen nye greier der, som kommer til å bli veldig tricky.
Jeg kjenner mange damer
også, som alle partier nødt til å tenke på.
Det mange damer som opptatt av å finne mening I jobben også.
Ja, da. Men det altså forskjeller, viser alt som finnes av undersøkelser der. Og så det veldig store forskjeller I hva partiene gjør med dem.
Og jeg har vært Nordens mykeste mann over hele forsiden av Dagbladet. På et tidspunkt, faktisk. Så.
Har du det?
Ja.
Det bildet?
Med bildet.
Det bildet skal jeg ta og legge ut som promotion for denne episoden.
Veldig bra.
Jeg kan jo ikke noe annet. Jeg har ikke noe bilde av Niklas Christakis å legge ut. Du burde være hvis jeg stjer det fra nettet. Så. Ok, det noe mer vi har å si?
Jeg håper at folk blitt litt nysgjerrig på noe som egentlig en veldig, veldig stor debatt.
Veldig altså, viktig.
For hvordan... Sånn, ny kunnskap om mennesket bør ha mye å si for hvordan vi bygger våre samfunn og behandler hverandre og jobbene våre og så videre. Så.
Jep, da skal jeg skal løpe ned på Kulturhuset, for der vi debatten om hvorvidt komikere har ytringsplikt. Eller noe I den duren der.
Tyvärr. Skal du delta, eller?
Tusen og Dag Søre også. Nei, det snart ferdig, så dessverre.
Nei, men det ser jo artig.
Ja, veldig morsomt.
Men det går... Du synes det
greit? Podcast.
Du synes det greit?
Det gjorde jeg. Selv om vi hadde for liten tid.
Ja.
Men nå slår jeg, og så sier vi ha det.
Ha det.
Ha det bra.